Hey y'all, welcome to another episode of Jesse's Fireside Chats. Today I'll be talking to you about several things. It's going to be kind of a catch-up episode because I took a bit of a break for Thanksgiving, and as I'm sure you can probably tell, I'm still on the tail end of fighting something. I don't know if it was a cold or just sinuses or what, but it's been a minute, so we're going to be doing a bit of a catch-up episode today. So the first thing I want to mention is, I know it's coming up in a couple months, literally 2 months from today, but I will not be covering the Olympics because not only is this a political podcast, so I wouldn't have much of a need to talk about them extensively anyway, but even if something relevant to them comes out, I probably won't be able to talk about it because I can't watch the Olympics because the Olympics are entirely metric, and longtime listeners know my issue with that, that I believe that the metric system violates the biblical commandment in Leviticus 19, verse 35 and 36 that tells us to avoid the use of unjust weights and measures. Because the metric system was created by French revolutionary communists who were actively rejecting God and created it to reject God, and it was imposed on most of the world. Actually, the whole world to one extent or another, because even the U.S. has it in some industries and on some packaging and in some other contexts. So, with that out of the way, I just wanted to say that it's a couple months out, but I will not be covering the Olympics, even if something politically relevant comes out about them. Also, even if I didn't have that conviction, the Olympics are not really my cup of tea anyway. Most of the sports that they play, especially in the Winter Olympics, I couldn't care less about if I tried. If you offered me $1 million to care less about the Olympics than I already did before all of this, I wouldn't be able to, you wouldn't be able to pay it to me because I literally would not be able to care any less. It would be like time travel, you know, be like asking me to go back in time. I simply couldn't do it. The threshold is literally on the ground. The bar is literally on the ground. I cannot. The bar is so low when it comes to how much I already care about the Olympics that I literally would not be able to, literally would not be able to care any less. So, especially about the Winter Olympics, even the summer ones, most of the sports they play, I don't care. I don't like soccer. I don't even know if they play soccer in the Olympics or not. That tells you how little I care. But I don't like soccer anyway. The only sports that I like, that I like to watch regularly are football, baseball, and basketball. And I can watch those just fine without all that extra drama. And also the Olympics, they were based on an ancient Greek series of games that were also called the Olympics. And the name should tell you that they were, they had pagan roots. So I already don't love the concept as it is. And I think globalization for its own sake is a recipe for disaster because as I said in my episode about Iran, actually, about when the U.S. bombed the Iran facilities, I said that one of the concerns I have when it comes to excessive internationalism, and I was saying this in a military context, but I think it applies here too, is when you compress something too much, it loses its original form and becomes something ugly and distorted. That's why when stars are on their last legs, they, not all of them, but some of them collapse into a black hole. I think it depends on the original size of the star. But when they do that, you know, they stop being a star. They become a black hole. And a black hole, as we know, basically sucks up anything that comes too close to it and destroys it. They destroy everything they touch. They're like Stitch in Lilo and Stitch. He breaks everything he touches, basically. That's essentially what a black hole does, except much worse. It's essentially like him combined with the... You know how teenage boys can eat everything? It seems like some of them are like garbage disposals. Yeah, a black hole is like one of those and Stitch combined. Because it destroys everything it touches and eats everything it touches. So, where I'm going with that is that when you compress something too much, it loses its original form and becomes something hideous. And that's the problem with globalization. God clearly wanted nations to have borders. That's not to say that every nation has to necessarily be a hermit and not interact with any other country in the world. Obviously, trade internationally was happening in the Bible, even. So that's not to say that there can be no international activity whatsoever. But when this forced, I guess nobody's forced to be in the Olympics, but when so many countries just, they just get together and they try to be too buddy-buddy with each other. They try to, make these global bodies like the UN. They try to basically forfeit their sovereignty in one aspect or another. In the name of some faceless cooperative, that's some of the first steps in the world becoming that overly compressed, hideous thing. I'm not saying that we are on a slippery slope, but I am saying we need to be cautious, because I will not say the words New World Order, because I'm pretty sure that belief encompasses some other elements that I do not wish to be associated with, like anti-Semitism. I do not have time for that. I have been clear about that before and will continue to be. But I will say that the final result of this compression being complete would be the world all becoming one country, one government. There being no national borders, no national sovereignty, one global culture. And I do believe that there is at least some kernel of truth to that whole idea that there are elites out there who want to create that. I mean, that's why we have the UN. That's why we have the International Criminal Court. That's why we have NATO. That's why... there's always this push for universalization and standardization and the metric system and, the European Union and, all of these other things. Now, I know that for the time being, a lot of those things are voluntary, other than the metric system has been imposed on the world. But, like, the European Union countries have to petition to join it. NATO countries have to ask for membership. UN countries have to decide to join it, I think, still. Not every country has signed on to the International Criminal Court. But these things are all voluntary right now. But if every country were to decide to sign on to it, then whether it was voluntary or not would become a moot point, because now every country has signed on to it, and not every citizen of every country has been consulted individually as to whether they want to join something like that. And I realize that direct democracy has never been a success in communities larger than a Greek city-state or a small town, but I will say that nothing can be truly voluntary if the government that only represents you in theory decides you're part of this thing now, and you have no actual say. Because as I've said before, the representatives we elect, they only really represent us in theory, because they, you know, we vote for them, but they don't just listen to us. Sometimes they don't listen to us at all. And even if they do, they're also listening to lobbyists, interest groups, which are not always the same thing. There is overlap there, but those are two distinct categories. Other members of their own party, the opposing party sometimes, because yes, bipartisanship does still sometimes exist, although it is much less common than it historically has been. They're also, you know, having all these other voices yelling in their one ear while we, the people, are whispering in their other ear. So they really don't always represent us in practice. I mean, it does say something when your representative has town halls, quote unquote. I would be doing air quotes if I wasn't holding a phone in one hand, and if this was a visual medium. But you know, it's definitely telling when you have a representative in Congress who does quote unquote town halls, but you have to register to be a part of it and be pre-screened to prevent anyone who will say anything that the representative disagrees with. I understand in a virtual event you need security of some sort because Zoom hacking is a thing. I understand all of that, but I also do acknowledge that when you are a representative, you are representing your constituents. Your constituents will not always agree with everything you're doing. And if you're going to have an event open to your constituents, like a town hall, for example, then you're going to have to live with the fact that some constituents won't always agree with you. So what I'm saying is, I understand vetting to make sure that the people in your virtual event are actual people that want to be there and not hackers or like people that are just going to disrupt that. But you'd have similar things at a physical event too. In person, you would have security that could, if somebody's heckling you or making threats or has a weapon, they could intervene and escort them out or have them arrested if the threat is severe enough or if they actually do attempt any funny business. But you wouldn't necessarily have them escort anyone out that disagrees with you just because they happen to disagree with you. I do think freedom of association is important. I've said that many, many times and will continue to. But I also understand that when you are a representative and you are having a town hall that is open to your constituents, you can't just tailor all the audience to be people that will agree with 100% of what you say and won't ask you any tough questions whatsoever. So where I'm going with all that is that is an example of how our representatives only represent us in theory. So if a international organization or treaty is voluntary, quote-unquote, it's only voluntary for the governments of the countries, not the people that actually live there. And if the government only represents us in theory, then if you want to get philosophical, the thing wasn't truly voluntary because it was only voluntary for the governments, which don't always take into account the needs and wants of their people. And so that's where I'm going with all that, is that Not all these global initiatives are truly voluntary, and also even if they are, even if we agreed for the sake of argument that they actually are voluntary, if every country chooses to join it, then whether it was voluntary to begin with is moot. And governments are very big fans of saying that something will be temporary, but making that thing permanent. I've said before and will say again, government is like a crappy house guest that never leaves. Imagine you have a house guest staying at your house, and he decides he's going to eat, sleep, and blast heavy metal at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's all he's going to do. He's not going to try to get a job or find another accommodation. He's not going to help you around the house. He's not going to do anything. And he is definitely going to disrupt you in the middle of the night, every night, while you're trying to sleep so you can go to your job and live your life. By blasting heavy metal at top volume at 2 in the morning. That's essentially what the government loves to do. It loves to come in to your house, take from you, take your money, and inconvenience you by doing things that are allegedly for your safety or for efficiency or for this or that, you know, passing all these new laws, creating new agencies, etc. But all that they do is, all that those end up doing is taking from you and making your life harder. Like the guy depriving you of sleep, and, you know, sanity by blasting heavy metal at 2 in the morning at top volume. The government essentially does the same thing by creating all these new laws and agencies and things that tax you way more than necessary and make your life more inconvenient. I mean, think of the TSA. TSA hasn't stopped a single terrorist attack, and yet we were told that they'd be temporary, but 25 years later, we still have the TSA treating everyone that wants to get on an airplane like cattle, making them take their shoes off and all this other stuff. So that's essentially where I've been going with all of this, is that the Olympics are just one more symptom of a much bigger and multifaceted problem, which is globalization for its own sake, which the metric system is also a symptom of, and this globalization for its own sake is a problem because when you compress anything too much, it becomes a much smaller, but also much uglier and more hideous version of itself that is nothing like the original. Think a black hole. Black hole looks nothing like a star. It eats everything it touches, destroys everything it touches. And it just, you know, it's not a star anymore. It doesn't do anything that a star does except, you know, exist in space and spin around. Beyond that, the black hole and the star are very different. So that's what would happen if the world became over-globalized in the way that I've described, where you had one, which we don't yet have this, but if you had one language, one culture, one country, one government, you know, you would end up with the same physical planet, same seas, same dirt, same weather, same, you know, same rocks, but it would be a very different place. Instead of different countries and different cultures, all living according to their own governments, their own sovereignty, their own values, which I might not agree with some of their values, but the point is that, you know, globalization, for one thing, the elites that would be in charge of such a global government would more than likely not prioritize God's word, or living according to it. They would very likely be progressive, and even leaving religion out of it for the sake of argument for a second, you know, instead of having different countries that live according to their own governments, their own sovereignty, their own culture, their own values, you would have one monoculture, one global culture that is completely detached from the actual experiences of the people who live in pretty much any country, except for maybe small pockets, small parts of the globe. It would probably be the culture of urban centers, and anyone living outside of those, the culture that the elites would want to impose would not be anything like the culture of most of the people of the globe. I mean, think of it this way. Even just zooming back into the U.S., people in California and in New York, they don't live exactly the same way. And even they, if you take both of those cultures, both of those environments, people from California and New York are not going to live the same way as someone from Idaho. And someone from Idaho is not going to live the same way as someone from Florida. Or even in Florida, someone that lives in Miami is probably not going to live the same way as someone that lives out in the middle of nowhere. And someone that lives in any part of Florida is not going to live the same way as someone in Kansas or Indiana. Because not all of the world, or even all of the same country, is going to be the same. The environment's different. The culture is different. The values are different. The resources they have to work with are different. I know this. A lot of this is elementary, but it reinforces the point. We should be very wary of any initiative that seeks to impose a global culture or make the world smaller, as a lot of these activists and groups will say. They will frame it in much more welcoming language. Instead of saying we want to impose a global culture and a global government, or even we want to unite everyone into one country, they will instead use much more inviting sounding language. Let's make the world smaller. Globalization makes the world smaller. It makes everything easier. It improves connection. That's what they'll say. But in Deuteronomy, God very clearly said that all nations should have borders. That's why he didn't let Israel take over the whole world. And that's also why he didn't leave the Israelites to live in Egypt. He had a country for them. It was Israel, and it was bigger than current Israel. That's why he had a country for them. He didn't just leave them in Egypt. He didn't just say everybody's going to live like Egypt and everybody's going to be Egyptian. No. And he didn't say, you're just Romans now. I mean, sure, Jesus didn't free them politically, but God also, you know, did still promise that Israel would the diaspora would come back together in Daniel. As at least that's what I've seen, that's what I've heard. Now, when do I think that'll happen? I don't know. I haven't given it too much thought because I think that is a promise that is for Israel and not for the rest of us. If it is a promise that is in there, which it does seem to be. So, I mean, you know, if God wanted everyone to be in one government, one global culture, he would have made that happen a long, long time ago. He would have never scattered the languages in the Tower of Babel, which was also partially punishment Actually, the main reason he did that was because they were trying to reach heaven, but if he had just wanted to punish them for building the tower itself and not their unity, he would have just, I don't know, rained fire on them or something. He wouldn't have scattered the languages. And yes, he did, on Pentecost, he did bring the people together, when it comes to the language thing, but, that was for his purposes. That wasn't, he had a reason for doing that. It was not just unity for its own sake, progress for its own sake. It was for the furtherance of his kingdom. So, what I'm saying here is that we should be very wary of any initiative, any group, any person that wants to make the world smaller for its own sake. Progress for its own sake in general is very dangerous, and we should be very wary of that. Not everything that's new is automatically better, and the Bible actually says that there is nothing new under the sun in Ecclesiastes. Now, next thing I want to get into, much lighter, is kid-free weddings. I think kid-free weddings are dumb. That may not be the most popular stance, but that is my stance. If you are going to get married, I believe, because I am a conservative Christian, I believe that part of the purpose of getting married is to have a family. Whether that means you physically have your own kids, or whether you can't do so and so you adopt. Either way, the part of the purpose of a marriage, in my view, is to have a family. Especially a first marriage. You know, not a marriage after you've been widowed. But marriage in general, that should be one of the main goals. And so, because of that, a wedding is at most a few hours. If you count the reception, it's probably like maybe 6 hours tops. Let's just assume that for round numbers. That the wedding and reception is 6 hours. I've never timed one, so I don't know exactly if that's accurate. But for round numbers, we're just going to assume that. So, if we assume that the average wedding and reception combined is 6 hours, then when you say that you want to have a kid-free wedding, and that's usually what's happening, it's not just that, oh, you look at the guest list and there happen to be no kids on it. No, it usually the people that want a kid-free wedding will make it very known that it is a kid-free wedding. That's what they want. When you say you want a kid-free wedding, not only are you imposing not only are you putting any parents in your life in a very awkward situation, because they have to either decide to not support you on your special day or to go out of their way to find someone who will watch the kids. And if they don't know someone who will do it for free, they have to hire someone to do it. And so that is potentially a financial burden you're asking them to take on to support you. In addition to, it is generally a custom that you should at least provide money, if not a gift, to a wedding. I know most of y'all would know that, but I'm just throwing it in here because it will reinforce what I'm about to say. You are asking people, that you are inviting to your wedding, that if they want to support you on your special day, they not only have to go to the expenses that all of us can understand of, you know, making sure they have a decent outfit if they don't have one already, making sure that they give you a gift or some money or something. We can understand those expenses, but you're asking them to throw on top of that, potentially, an extra expense of paying someone to watch their kids because, heaven forbid, they bring kids to your wedding. I'll also say it's childish. It's childish to say you don't want kids at your wedding because, you know, if you can't handle kids for 6 hours, how are you going to handle them when they're living under your roof? So this is going to be controversial, but grow up, okay? If you want a kid-free wedding, then you are the kid. You need to grow up. That is my view. May not like it, but that is my perspective. Kid-free weddings are dumb. Whoever invented them should share a jail cell with the guy who invented group chats and the guy who invented self-checkout. And the other thing I wanted to get into is redistricting. Indiana is trying to redistrict. I saw today that the proposed redistricting bill has passed the Indiana House. I know a lot of y'all may not be from Indiana, but I am, so I am going to talk about it. Because everybody's getting all up in a knot about it, and I don't see a problem with it. It is more advantageous to the GOP, sure, but both sides engage in redistricting that advantages their party. California is trying to redistrict to be more advantageous to the Democrats. So I don't see any problem with Indiana redistricting to be more advantageous to the Republicans. I've talked before about my thoughts on how we should do districts, how we should draw them after presidential elections instead of at random or after the census, and how we should have AI do it to lessen human interference, human partiality. But if we're not doing that, if we're sticking to the real world where that's not how we do it, then I don't see a problem with Indiana redrawing the districts to be more advantageous to the Republicans, because, you know, if California can do it, then there's no reason why Indiana can't. That's basically my view on that. That is one of the cases where I think that people are just looking for something to whine about. 'Cause the only argument I've heard against it is some people have said that it's undemocratic. They mean it with a lowercase d, but undemocratic, because of the Republican advantage. But I don't think so, because, I mean, think about it. Any map you draw is going to advantage one party or the other if we're going to have humans drawing the districts. That's just the way it is. Until we adopt what I've proposed or something similar, that's going to be the way it happens. And Democrats will always be a minority in a red state like Indiana, just like Republicans will always be a minority in a blue state like California or New York or Colorado. So I think that some of the criticism of this is overblown. And those are just kind of my thoughts on it. Sure, the districts are weird shaped, yes, but that's always going to be what happens when humans draw them. So unless you're for AI drawn districts, drawn after the election, after the presidential election is finalized, if you're for districts that are drawn by humans, who, as I've said, will always be biased because an unbiased human is as common as a vegan cat, you know, if you're for that system, and if that's the system we have, if nobody wants to change it, then don't complain about it. It's just like the people who don't vote in the election. Like, they'll say, oh, my vote doesn't matter, my vote this, that, or the other. They don't vote in the presidential election, or I guess this could be true for any election, but I hear it most when it comes to the president. You'll have people who don't vote in the presidential election. They've had plenty of opportunity to do so. They could vote early, they could vote the day of, they could whatever. And they don't. They don't bother. Then after the election results come out, they complain about it. And it's like, yes, your vote single-handedly probably won't impact who wins. Two-party system is not perfect. I've talked about that before. But if you're not even going to try, if you're not even going to vote at all, then some people will say that you're giving a vote to the candidate they don't like, but that's not the case. You're not giving your vote to either one. So you don't have any real right. I mean, legally you have a right, but you don't really have any right to complain and expect your complaint to have any weight if you were legally able to vote and you didn't. It's one thing if you live in a state where they don't let felons vote at all after their conviction, which I've said I think ex-cons should vote after they're free in the eyes of the court. It's one thing if that's the case, or if you're not a citizen, or if you're under 18, whatever, you can't vote, okay, fine. But if you were legally able to vote, and you didn't, you could have, you didn't, you just didn't bother, you really don't have much of a right to complain about what happens either way. Your complaint does not hold much weight because you didn't even try. Now, if you voted for one guy and the other guy won and you complain, okay, yes, you have more weight because you actually did vote. You know, that you actually voted, but the person you voted for lost. At least you went to the trouble of actually voting. But if you didn't, then I don't want to hear it. Like, if you didn't vote and you could have legally, I don't want to hear about how unhappy you are about who won. It's just like if you're with a group of friends or family and you're all trying to figure out what to eat and they tell you, you know, we'd like to know what your input is, and you just say, I don't care, or you don't say anything at all, and then they pick a place, like, I don't know, they all decide they want pizza, and then after the pizza gets there, or after you get to the restaurant, you complain, I didn't want pizza, I wanted Mexican, I didn't want Mexican, I wanted sushi, whatever it is. Well, your complaint does not hold much weight because you were given a chance to give your input. You were able to. Your mouth clearly works just fine because you're able to use it to complain after the fact. You know, you had the opportunity to give your input. Doesn't necessarily mean your suggestion would have been the one that got picked, but you had an opportunity to give your input, you didn't, so I don't want to hear you complain about what everybody else decided around you, okay? Those are basically my thoughts on that. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is striking. I've been clear before, and will continue to be, that I think if you go on strike, your employer should have every right to fire you, and we should celebrate when they do. Because I do think unions had a purpose in the 20th century, the 19th century, when you had people working nonstop with little to no breaks and, you know, very low wages and kids getting their fingers ripped off in machines. I do think at that point there was a purpose for unions, but I think unions outlived their usefulness about a century ago, and now they're just your local whining machine. Labor unions are now just the local neighborhood whining machine at this point. A lot of times, the things that when they go on strike, actually pretty much any time they go on strike nowadays, it's because they want things that are either unreasonable or that maybe could be done, but that they don't actually need. You know, they might want more vacation, more bonuses, more this, more that. Okay, great, I guess, but it's not worth throwing a hissy fit over it. And that's essentially what you're doing when you walk out and go on strike. You're basically throwing a hissy fit. And it's like if I don't know, I think that if you work in a if you live and work in a country where you have, you know, you make above minimum wage, you don't have to get up in the morning and milk cows and go to the well 3 miles away and carry water, you have it pretty good. You have a roof over your head, you have you have air conditioning at your work and most of the time at home. You have pretty much everything you could ever need and want. I mean, sure, there are many things you might want, but you can't afford. That's called budgeting. That's called basic financial responsibility. But, you know, you live in a country where you have it pretty good compared to most people throughout most of human history. And even today in many parts of the world, there are people who have it much worse than you do. And yet you're going out on strike. I just think that is ridiculous. I don't know if the Starbucks people are striking right now. I know they were recently. I know that it seems like every few months you hear about some workers at some corporation or another going out on strike. Starbucks is the case that most jumps out at me right now, and that's why I have this on my mind. But, you know, you live in a country where you have it pretty good compared to most people throughout most of human history and many people today, and yet this is your priority. I do think that, you know, if you are hired to do a job, your employer should have the right to fire you if you refuse to work. And that's essentially what you're doing when you go on strike. It's one thing if your employer asks you to do something impossible. Like if you go into work and your employer says, I want you to put 30 elephants on your head. Obviously, that's impossible and unreasonable. So you would have to refuse to do that. But that's generally not what's happening here. So I think that this whole idea that strikers should be protected and replacing them is bad, I think that that is, it's outdated. And, it is, we need to stop this nonsense. You know, I thought we were supposed to be adults. And I think that, you just, you know, you're there to work. Obviously there's more to you than just your work. Everybody knows that. I'm not saying you have to give 24/7 to your job. I would think that's very excessive, to put it mildly, understatement of the century, but you're there to work. You're probably there for like, unless you have a job that has a lot of overtime, which some do, you're probably there for an average of 40 hours a week. The 40-hour work week saying didn't come out of thin air. It is a decent chunk of time, but it's not your whole life. So, I don't know. I just think that there are better things to do than go to work and throw hissy fits about things that are not critical to your survival. I mean, I also think that, you know, if you go to work, if you have a coworker and all they do is stir up drama and cause division, employers shouldn't have to tolerate that crap either. This is not middle school anymore. I actually think it's pretty good to say that you gotta be 16 to do most jobs, especially most people-facing jobs, because there is a certain maturity that should be expected in the workplace. And people that are gonna do stuff like that, stuff like going on strike for trivial things or starting drama, sowing division at work, I just don't think that there is a place for that in a professional setting, and so I don't think employers should have to put up with that. That's also why I don't think that you should be shocked if you go online and you post about how much you hate your job and your bosses are this and your coworkers are that and you hate it so much you don't want to be there anymore. Your employer should have every right to fire you, and any future employer should have every right to look at that and say, you know what, I don't think we need this person, because I don't think we want to hire this person because, you know, they might do this to us next, and it doesn't look good. So those are basically my thoughts on that. I guess the first theme of this episode was really heavy in that we need to be wary of progress for its own sake, because it is inherently dangerous to just want to fix things, quote unquote, that aren't broken, and to try to compress the world into this artificially small, distorted version of itself that erases culture and sovereignty. You know, that was the big theme of today. And then the lighter theme, I guess, is that people just need to grow up. I think this world would be a much better place if people would just stop always looking for reasons to be upset and outraged, and would instead do what the Bible encourages us to do and look for reasons to be thankful. Because it could be so much worse, you know. If you live in a country where you have a roof over your head, you have food in your belly, you have clothes on your back, you are not in an active war zone, you have freedom of speech, it could be a lot worse. You could be a caveman eating rocks. You could be in a war zone. You could be in a tribe that gets raided in the middle of the night. You could be a slave that's having to work nonstop and not get paid at all. You know, you could be a peasant in the Middle Ages, bound to the land, can't leave. You're stuck there. You can't hop from job to job because the lord of the land has to give you permission to leave, and he probably won't, and you are stuck there. You have to work for him, do what he wants. He decides who you marry and when. He decides, potentially, he can decide, he can decide a lot of things in your life that are outside of just work. You know, you could be stuck in that situation. It's called serfdom. You don't want that. You could be homeless on the street. I mean, we do have those. I said a country where you have a roof on your head, but I was kind of just lumping those two things together. We do have homeless people here. You know, you could be that. You could be someone that has to live on a dollar a day. I don't know if there's still people that live on actually a dollar a day. But it would not surprise me if in some third world country, there are people that still have to live that way. So, you know, if you get paid $15 an hour or whatever, you have it a lot better than those people do. So I guess all I wanted to say on this is what I've said before, that strikers should be fired. You know, the employer doesn't have to, but they shouldn't be forced to not fire the strikers either. They should have a right to do so. Labor unions have outlived their usefulness, in my view. I've said those things before, but just reinforcing them. And then I guess I just wanted to say that I think, you know, the Bible tells us to focus on being thankful. And I think that so much of the idiocy we see in today's politics and culture comes from people just looking for reasons to be offended and for reasons to be upset and to feel put upon and oppressed. You know, people throwing a fit because they're not called by whatever their quote-unquote preferred pronouns are. People going on strike for dumb reasons. People just always wanting to talk to a manager. That's the whole Karen thing. People leaving some of the weirdest complaints I've ever heard, because I do sometimes watch complaint videos to unwind. You know, I just think that, and I'm sure it's always been this way to an extent, but I do think it's gotten really bad, and I think we need to try to, you know, get into a spirit of thankfulness and positivity rather than just always looking for the negative. So those are my thoughts on that. I hope that you have enjoyed this podcast. I know it ran a little long because I had a lot on my mind. It was kind of a catch-up episode because of the long kind of break that I took. Either way, I still hope you enjoyed it. Consider it to be food for thought. Hopefully the next episode will be a little bit more organized. I hope you'll pass this along to anybody you know that might be interested. You can find this podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, the RSS feed, iHeartRadio, Audible, and Pandora. You can also contact us on our Facebook page at Jesse's Fireside Chats and on X at JFSCPod. You can also feel free to email us at jessesfiresidechats@gmail.com. That's JESSEAS firesidechats@gmail.com. You can also feel free to reach out to us either through that email or through messaging us on our social media pages. If you'd like to be a guest, we'd love to have a guest at some point. We have a coffee page, so no pressure. But if you'd like to leave us a small donation, we would really appreciate it. That's kofi.com/Jesse's Fireside Chats. Thank you so much for listening, and have a blessed day.